You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War. On this episode of our Spanish Civil War interview series, I was joined by Harry Taylor, a PhD researcher who focuses on the reaction of Britain to the Spanish Civil War. Harry has done a lot of research into information like how the Civil War was portrayed in British newspapers and the grassroots efforts to try and assist those experiencing hardship in Spain. We talked about many different topics, including milk tokens, a very ingenious way of bringing awareness to the public and of raising money for powdered milk to be sent to Spain. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Spanish Civil War interview series. Today, I'm joined by Harry Taylor, a PhD student at Sheffield Hallam University, who's currently researching Britain and the Spanish Civil War. Harry, how's it going today?
It's going well. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Excellent. Okay, so we're here to talk about Britain and the Spanish Civil War. And so after the Civil War started, the national British press, notably the Times and the Daily Mail, were perhaps not portraying information in an unbiased way. In some of your previous research, you contrasted this with a more local paper. How did those two kind of differ? Go ahead.
So the ways in which the national press report this, the stories in Spain, do vary. Certain newspapers have certain aspects that they promote more than others. So the Times is very much a newspaper concerned with non-intervention. The First World War is a very recent memory for a lot of people in Britain and across the world, obviously. And there isn't an overwhelming desire for another conflict in Britain. People don't want another war. And the Times very much stays on this trajectory of promoting non-intervention. Britain has to stay out of the war to stop the conflict in Spain spilling over into a European or global conflict. That is very much their line. The Daily Mail, which is the biggest selling newspaper in Britain at the time, very much takes an anti-republican stance. They are by no means pro Largo Caballero, who from September 1936 to May 1937 was joint Minister of War and Prime Minister of the Spanish Republic. They start to refer to him as the Spanish Lenin. They give the blanket term of all Republican supporters as just the Reds. And they very much focus on the belief that they hold, which is that Spain will become a Soviet puppet if the Republic wins. The Soviet Union has started arming the Spanish Republic, much like Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy had started arming the rebels. And the Spanish Republic had spent a lot of money acquiring war materials from the Soviet Union in the first 12 months, something around $100 million. So they very much focus on this line of if the Republic wins, Spain will become just another satellite state of the Soviet Union that will essentially be annexed. And there are concerns in the upper echelons of British society about this. At the time, people in Britain have around £40 million worth of private investment in Spain, which they fear will be nationalized if the Republic wins because of the Soviet influence. So the Daily Mail very much reports this with those concerns at the forefront. In contrast, local newspapers can really scale down their reporting. They can focus more on stories of people from their local area who are fighting over in Madrid, if that's possible, which in some cases it is. Stories of people who've gone out to Spain and been killed or come back and given their story of what's happened over there are much more prominent in local newspapers than national newspapers for obvious reasons. So that contrast between national reporting and local reporting gives a different perspective for a whole range of reasons.
Do you know how papers are getting their information about what's happening in Spain?
There's varied ways in which they get their information. I mean, to start with, Spain goes into a blackout, essentially, and it's very much up in the air as to what is happening. But first-hand accounts are really important. People sending back reports. People who are already over in Spain at the time, people who have made their way over, people who have maybe been in Spain when war broke out and then came back. But again, the way that these are reported does change depending on the publication. So there is a story printed in the Daily Mail in 1936, towards the end of 1936, in which they detail a story about a massacre of Catholic clergymen in southern Spain. The source that they use for this is Francisco Franco himself, a senior general in the rebel army. That isn't to say, obviously, that these, again, terrible things didn't happen. But like I say, the ways in which these are used and the people that are used when it comes to first-hand accounts definitely does make for interesting reading depending on what publication it is.
I know there was a lot of humanitarian support for Spain that originated in Britain at this time. It seems to be organized around an Aid Spain umbrella. What was Aid Spain and how was it set up nationally and locally?
Well, Aid Spain is a retrospective term given, really, to the umbrella organizations that undertook relief campaigns for Spain. So no organization actually called Aid Spain did exist. Like I said, it's a retrospective term. The closest there was at the time to a sort of governing body that was in charge of aid to Spain was the National Joint Committee for Spanish Relief. They were an umbrella organization which included people of varying different political beliefs. There was everybody in there from John McNamara, who was a Conservative MP, Eleanor Rathbone, who was an independent MP, Wilfred Roberts, who was liberal, and they very much had the purpose of, through this umbrella organization, raising as much funds for Spain as possible without the divisions of party politics. But the most interesting thing about Aid to Spain in Britain, and one of the things that really drew me to it, was that it's such a fluid movement. So yes, there was this sort of de facto centralized umbrella organization, but actually there were so many different organizations across the country as well. Very independent, very local, and varied in what they were raising funds for. So the National Joint Council doesn't come about until the end of 1936. But war's declared war breaks out in July. And straight away in Britain, people start to raise funds. One of the ways in which they do this is they take pre-existing organizations that they already belong to and they morph those into aid organizations. So at the time in Britain, there was an organization called the Left Book Club, which ended in the late 1940s. And think has actually started up again recently in some form. But essentially it was, as you would expect, an organization that distributed and promoted left-wing literature. And these groups were already organized with people of similar political sympathies. And they made great vessels, essentially, to transform into an aid organization. The structure was already there, the members were already there. So there's a contrast between, like I say, this sort of umbrella organization and then the local independent organizations as well.
You mentioned different political beliefs. How would the different political beliefs affect what these groups were doing? Or was it just, you know, you are too far left for me, so I'm not going to give you money, no matter what you say you're going to do with it?
It does cause problems more in the actual organizations themselves than how they attempt to interact with the public and at a grassroots level. So, as I mentioned, there's the National Joint Council, but the Trade Union Congress, affiliated to the Labour Party, refuses to work with communists and those affiliated to the Communist Party. There are aspects of the Labour Party and the TUC that are very sceptical and suspicious of communism and communists at the time. And there are some fundraising endeavours that they refuse to become involved in because they're too closely linked to the Communist Party, and that leads to the TUC deciding that there is official and unofficial relief work for Spain. Official being relief work that doesn't involve the communists, and unofficial relief work being the relief work that does involve the communists. But at a grassroots level, they try to avoid that. Like I say, these different organizations, they completely vary in how they can raise funds for Spain and how they can be organized. And they include so many different people of different political backgrounds and even people who are not members of political parties or maybe even apolitical. They just see this as the right thing to do, the humanitarian cause. So with regard to, and this is what my research specifically looks at, with regard to how the message is dispersed amongst the public in Britain, any overt mentions of party politics tend to be avoided. They focus more on the devastating effects of the war, the food shortages, the medical crisis, the refugee crisis that comes. And you see this on the actual material itself, which is distributed to promote these fundraising organizations. Images of families torn apart by war. Very, very rarely do these images include a man or a man of fit, healthy, fighting age. If men are depicted on these images, it is usually a frail old man. These images usually concern women and children. It promotes a sort of vulnerability of the Spanish people and their suffering. And it's trying to bring about an emotional response from the British Republic based on this being a simple case of right and wrong rather than anything overtly party political.
You mentioned leaflets and images there. How did these groups get information to as many groups as possible? You know, how did they, I guess, manage their public relations campaign?
So some of the most effective ways are just very simple and straightforward. They organize door-to-door leafleting campaigns, just as straightforward as that. So these are very, in some cases, so with regard to Sheffield, which is one of the examples that I look at in my research, one of the aid organizations there, because again, another aspect of this is that towns and cities may have more than one aid organization, depending on what they're raising money for. It could be food or medical supplies. One of the aid organizations there that morphs from the Left Book Club, they have a very strict and regimented system where every Wednesday night they would go to different parts of the city, push flyers through the door saying, we're raising funds for X in Spain. We'll be back on Friday. Please place any donations into this envelope. Or a lot of the times they were after canned food that could be sent over, and they would come back a few days later and they would collect what these people had given. And these leaflets and flyers sort of double up in their intent in a way. So the collection envelopes in a lot of cases that are pushed through the door and contain the information about we're raising funds for whatever it may be, a lot of the time they also mimic images that are seen on posters or in any other kind of environment. So you will start to see a poster depicting a refugeed family, which may be put up at an event at a town hall or a city hall where somebody is speaking. And then this exact same image is replicated onto an envelope, which is then put through someone's door when they are trying to raise money for collections. So they very much take Spain out of the newspapers and almost into people's front rooms in a way with this imagery and with these leafleting campaigns. But also, like I say, there's talks and rallies that are held, film showings. There's a huge variety of ways that they get the message out there. But yeah, some of the simpler tactics are the more effective.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned these different groups that are targeting different things. Were there groups that specialized in raising or are trying to get specific types of support, just money or maybe just food, for example?
Or something else?
Yeah, there are. So with regard to food, food ship for Spain, there are several food ships that take collections of canned and tinned food and powdered milk and other such supplies from Britain over to Spain for people there who are obviously experiencing the food shortages. Medical aid as well is another one. The North Manchester Medical Aid Association, set up in 1936 with Communist Party backing, they raise funds specifically for purchasing of medical equipment, or even in some cases to send over people who are medically trained. There are specific aspects of relief which are targeted by certain organisations. But again, a lot of the time, because of the nature of this fundraising, the fact that it is so fluid, you may get an organisation that at one point raises money for this particular aspect of relief, and then a few months later is raising money for another.
In some of the research I did for this interview, including some of your own writing, you mentioned something called milk tokens as a way of raising funds. So were there any sort of kind of unique fundraising campaigns or public awareness campaigns? I think milk tokens are pretty unique. And so were they found to be successful?
The milk tokens is one of my favorite things. You can't really look at British involvement with regard to aid and the Spanish Civil War without touching on milk tokens. It's a brilliant scheme. It's incredibly successful, and it really engages with the public. So the milk token scheme is set up by the co-op party, and the idea is that you can go into your local co-op store, which are everywhere in Britain. Even today, co-ops are just everywhere. And for 3 or 6 pence, depending on what you can afford, so again, they're making this affordable for people who maybe don't have as much money disposable. For 3 or 6p, you can buy a milk token, and then that money is used to buy powdered milk, which can be sent over to give to Spanish children, young Spanish children who are experiencing the shortages of food and other supplies. And it's incredibly successful. It raises around £25,000 over the time that it exists. And it's usually accompanied with quite, in some cases, distressing imagery. In some of these leaflets, again, in which the co-op milk token scheme is promoted, there will be pictures of quite disheveled, war-weary looking children, rags, looking completely lost and hopeless. And more often than not, it comes with a direct appeal to the reader or to whoever is viewing this particular image. So quite often it will say things like, "What can you do to help?" Or, you know, it will just very much bring home the vulnerability and the innocence of these children. And but one really particularly sort of harrowing image is a poster that is commissioned by the National Joint Council and designed by a Communist Party member. And it speaks of the need to raise funds to buy milk to help these children, but it shows a very sort of artistic interpretation of an emaciated child and their mother, and it's really really quite shocking to see. So like I say, this very accessible, very affordable means of raising money for something as simple as milk to help children really was successful and really did appeal to people's emotions and their empathy. And like I say, it works very well. Another way that people involved in these organizations one, got the message out there, but two, also raised funds was through film. Film and cinema as a medium was relatively new, late 1930s. But during the First World War in Britain, when people would go to the cinema, before the shows started, they would usually be shown a short propaganda clip of how the war was going over on the Western Front, usually. And certain organizations take the growing popularity of the cinema, and they use it to the benefit of Spanish aid and relief for Spain. So one of the really successful films that is made and shown across Britain is a film called The Defense of Madrid, which 2 years ago at the International Brigade Memorial Trust conference. The International Brigade Memorial Trust is an organization set up to preserve and promote the history and the memory of the men and women who went from Britain to fight for the international brigades. If anybody is interested in that aspect, they are well worth looking up. But 2 years ago, I was at their conference and they had the Defense of Madrid on microfilm, as it would have been shown then. And we watched it, and this film traveled across Britain and was shown in cinemas and local town halls and all kinds of other venues. And it's a silent film, not very long, showing day-to-day life in Madrid whilst it is under siege in late 1936. And some of the imagery is absolutely fascinating, but really quite emotive. It's destroyed houses, devastated streets, people rummaging, looking for their belongings in amongst the rubble. And then in some cases, just life going on as normal. People getting the bus to work or going to the shops. And it gives a real insight into daily life in a city that is under siege. And again, it kind of, like I mentioned earlier with the leaflets, takes the conflict from the newspapers and really puts it in front of people for them to see. And the Defence of Madrid alone raised £6,000 across Britain. And it wasn't the only film. Spanish Earth and other films, which involve people like Orson Welles narrating them. And, you know, things like this, they were created and toured, for want of a better word, across Britain to raise funds. And they're incredibly successful.
The Civil War goes on for several years. Were there any problems trying to keep momentum going on these campaigns over time? Was there a kind of ebb and flow to support?
There are, yeah. And that leads to some organizations having to change up how they do things. The initial enthusiastic response, like I say, like you alluded to, starts to wear off after 3 years. Of course, this is the 1930s. Britain itself isn't in the best situation economically. You know, people don't have a lot to give. One of the most surprising and kind of heartwarming things that I've discovered in researching this is that actually in a lot of cases, it was people who had the least who gave the most. Some of the most successful areas up and down Britain where these aid groups campaigned and asked for donations were working class areas. But after 3 years, and with, like I say, Britain itself being in its own financially difficult situation, and so many different campaigns springing up, the donations do, for some relief organizations, start to slow down. So in 1937, there's a camp in Salford, just outside Manchester, which is set up for assisting and helping and caring for a small number of children who have come over from the Basque region as part of the Basque refugee crisis. And towards the end of 1937, donations for that particular camp and that particular organisation really start to slow down, to the extent where the actual camp itself is disbanded and the children are sent to other ones across the country because there's just not enough money coming in to support it. So that there are aspects of this where funds and donations do slow down. But one of the most fascinating things that I found is that actually in some form, aid and relief actually carries on after the official end date of the conflict itself.
Which is impressive given the overall situation in the late 1930s after the conflict ends.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, a lot of those are for, the sort of perspective then changes. So a lot of those are for wounded British citizens coming back who have been fighting with the international brigades, or widows who obviously, you know, their husband has been killed fighting out in Spain. So the perspective changes, but the campaigning continues nonetheless, just in a different form.
Thank you for joining me here today for this interview. It's been very enlightening.
No, thank you very much for having me.